What's up, everyone? This week on the pod, I got Eric Ozine from Unit Pride, Redemption 87, and the Nerve Agents. So that's coming up in a second. Also, if you have not yet ordered the new Retaliate LP, you got to go over to indecisionrecords.com and order that. The silkscreen B-side with like the Walsby art is only available on the pre-order, so handle business, get that before it's gone forever. And also pick up the other records. The Abrasion went up for pre-order, and I think there's an Unbroken long sleeve that is fucking tight. And get that tuning record, get that Death by Stereo. You know what to do. Go to indecisionrecords.com and handle business. Also, please subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen to it. Also, if you have the time, like it, rate it, review it. If you want to go the extra mile, you can go to patreon.com/185milessouth and become a monthly Patreon. $1 gets you behind the paywall. And those are some of the most fun and best episodes. Like that Rob Moran Patreon, good God, man. There's a story that Daniel tells at the end of him and Rob and Don going to watch like a local indie pro wrestling show here in San Diego that is something else. So yeah, there's good shit on there. Check it out. And let's get on with the pod.
"185 Miles South", a hardcore punk rock podcast.
What's up, everyone? This week on the pod, I got Eric Ozine from Unit Pride, Redemption 87, the Nerve Agent, Said Radio, and probably a million others that I haven't heard of, or I'm too dumb to know. Anyway, what's up, Eric? Thanks for doing the pod.
I appreciate being on. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and I do believe it is our first NorCal representation, so you have the weight of the bay on your shoulders. I apologize.
Oh, oh, wonderful.
Do you remember how you got into punk hardcore, or punk and hardcore, and like what year that would have been?
Boy, what year was that? 84?
Nice.
I believe it's 84. I was in middle school, and I got into punk, not necessarily hardcore right off the bat. I was, you know, it was like Clash, Sex Pistols, Suicidal Tendencies, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
a lot of skateboarding.
That makes sense. I mean, that's the first stuff you get into. Not everyone's lucky like me that gets to discover Redemption 87 when they're 16. You know,
but let me tell you this though. So right after I got into that, I got handed a mixtape, which was awesome. It was the first Social Distortion album. It was 7 Seconds of the Crew, Circle Jerks, I think Wild in the Streets. I mean, it was awesome, and it just launched me into what was hardcore at the time. Not necessarily like straight edge hardcore, but just hardcore in general, and from there I just took off lots of punk, lots of hardcore, and eventually when I was 16 I got Youth of Today. So you know,
yeah. Why do you think that stuff resonated with you more than like the first wave punk stuff?
Well, actually I could totally nail that one down. So I came from a family filled with substance use, lots of drinking, lots of drugs. You know, my dad was not really around so much. I barely saw him. He was out using. My stepdad was an alcoholic. Like, I was really against all that stuff. Yet, I found myself in it because I was in the punk scene and there's a lot of it going on. And, you know, when Youth of Today hit, like 7 Seconds, you know, had that going on. But when Youth of Today hit and I saw them live, you know, I'd listened to him like the week before. Somebody gave me a tape, so we're going to go see this band. You should check them out. I really liked them. But when I saw them, like, I really got it. And then, like, it was all over at that point. And those guys were around for like a whole week. So I got to see them again the next weekend in the Bay at Gilman Street. And this was like 1987 at this point. And, I mean, I was just hooked. Well, I mean, that's clear because I'm clearly ripping off Ray Capo and my style of singing. So, you know.
Are you or are you doing the Antidote voice? Because I heard that you and Ray are both going for Antidote.
Well, that's true. That's a good point. So because of Ray, I got into Antidote. I got into Straight Ahead. And, you know, those three right there were really my influence in how I sang. I mean, I really, at 16, I wanted to be Ray Capo. Even though I knew Ray Capo, I wanted to be him, you know, and then out of that, you know, I came out of that, you know. So eventually I didn't want to be Ray Capo anymore after like 6 months, but, you know, that's kind of how it all started.
What do you remember?
Go ahead.
Sorry. No, you're here to talk.
No, I was going to say, I just got fed a lot of New York hardcore through those bands. We tracked down, you know, Maximum Rock and Roll used to have, I mean, they just stopped doing it, but they had the zine, and we would comb the zine looking for anything straight edge and youth crew esque and pull off of that. And then when we talked to all those bands, they would be like, oh, did you hear this band? Did you hear this band? And eventually we would just order their stuff or find their records. And then we would start sharing tapes back and forth, that kind of thing. Same year, I saw you today in the summertime on the Breakdown the Walls tour in 1987. I ended up going to New York. Crazy story about just hopping a plane. I spared change and forged my mom's check to fly to New York and stay with Walter, Youth of Today and Gorilla Biscuits, and ended up staying at his house, and you know, he was showing me all this stuff, and then of course he was hanging out with the Gorilla Biscuits and hanging out with various different people like Ray Capo, and just like getting all of this information for somebody from the Bay Area who didn't have that information at first. I came back from the Bay Area and, you know, unleashed that upon everybody in Unit Pride who I was in at that time, and then we totally converted into the style that you know us as. Because before that, we were, well, we started out as Misled Children. That was our name. And then we were playing a lot of their straight up punk stuff from like the style of Circle Jerks or 7 Seconds, early stuff, and, you know, that kind of stuff. So we evolved right off of all of that youth crew kind of stuff because I just, like, jumped into the deep end of the pool in 1987, and just that was what happened.
Yeah. What did you do in New York when you're out there? Did you get to go see shows?
Yeah. I went to the Pyramid Club and saw Warzone and Super Touch, and that was amazing. And I went to the Anthrax with Gorilla Biscuits and saw them play there. They were selling like their very first t-shirts at that show, which we were like screen printing days before, and, you know, some, you know, rigged like sort of screen print job. We were screen printing like pillowcases and all that kind of stuff. It was really fun. Very cool. The guys out there were so amazing. And, you know, we did that. I went to the Right Track Inn, saw Token Entry, out in Long Island, I think it was. Those are the three shows I think I went to. I don't think there was any more than that because I was only there for like 2 weeks. And it was November, so it was like winter, fall, winter.
Yeah, circling back to seeing Youth of the Day those two times, can you describe what it was like to see Youth of the Day in 1987?
Oh my God. So for a 16-year-old kid who, I mean, So I'd come from that scene in 1987, Operation Ivy was playing. And we played a lot of shows with them starting in 1987 all the way to 1989, which is essentially their time. They had a hell of a lot of energy. But they didn't carry the same like aggressive energy that Youth of Today had. Even though Youth of Today has these incredibly positive lyrics, they're very much like coming at you with them in this really intense sort of hardcore style, right? It's very East Coast. And so when I saw them, I'd not seen anything like that before. And I told Tim, who's also a Unipride guitar player, I told him after, I said, I will never play any different than I saw them play tonight. And if I do, I shouldn't be playing. And so that was like my whole thing, because they just jumped off the stage. They were coming right at you. They were like in your face, and there was like all the sing-alongs, all that kind of stuff. And that was not what we got in Northern California at that time. At least I had never seen it. So to have that was incredible.
Yeah. And was Gilman packed? Like, were they super popular by then?
Yeah, because they were put onto a bill with a lot of bands from all over the place. I think they played Sticky on one of the shows, and they were like a Gilman mainstay kind of band. There was a handful of bands. I don't know if you've seen the Turn It Around documentary.
I did.
Yeah. So those guys from Sticky are very prominent in that documentary, and they were playing on one of the bills. So I think a lot of the punk scene at the time, who was kind of in the know, knew of Youth of Today, because the Maximum Rock and Roll radio show was on every Wednesday. And so Tim Yohannan would play all of this stuff and stuff you just couldn't find. And of course, he's got the Maximum Rock and Roll zine going on. So he's getting all of this. He has like his finger on everything at that point, music wise, around the country, whereas we didn't have the internet back then. So, you know, everything is coming through fanzines and letter writing and people who may just happen to travel, because not many bands were even touring, really, you know?
Right.
So to have those avenues through the zine and through the radio show, a lot of the Gilman Street community, which it was very much like a tight-knit community, there was very much a core of that place. And I think they all kind of knew who Youth Today was, and so everybody saw them, plus they were there to see Sticky, and I don't know who else were on the bills at that time, but yeah, they were packed. And pretty much, I mean, you could go to a lot of Gilman shows and they were packed, just because that's where everybody went.
Yes.
You know, it's like the CBGBs of the West Coast kind of thing.
Sure. Sure. That's rad. Does Unipride do one demo, or do you do two different demos? I'm a little confused, because the,
do I have to say,
well, please, you said the right here straight, but, you know, Igby does the Unipride LP in 2002, and it has the mm-hmm. Holding On Strong demo on it. But then on Discogs, there's a different demo that, I haven't seen before that's listed. So
yeah,
there's two, but there's one that you like and one you don't.
There's one I hate. I hate it so much. We were playing it once in Tim's car driving down the road, and I couldn't stand it. And so I pulled it out of the tape thing and tossed it out the window on the freeway, because the thing sucked. Anyway.
You signed it to Roadside Records. It's an old tour classic.
Yeah, that's right. That's where you can get it. That demo was our first demo. We had just changed our name to Unipride. We were playing all of our earliest stuff from like 1985, and you know, songs like Fuck the Flag and Adams for Peace was on there, which was like if you were part of our like little crew of folks from the San Ramon Valley, you know, there's kind of a joke around that song just because of the sing-along, but you know, just very like punk rock, you know, Atomic Bombs, you know, Screw America kind of stuff, like that sort of stuff. And it was like just slowed down. It wasn't like the more, not that we're like super aggressive or anything in Unipride in the second demo, but it was much more what we became. So the first demo reflects who we are initially, and the second one reflects who we became. And so the second one was recorded at Gilman Street. That's the one Igby has. And that's it. There is a demo. And if I see it, I will throw it out the window.
Yeah. So the demo that you like comes out in 87, or is that 88 as well?
That's 87, and I think our record came out actually in the beginning of 88.
Yeah, on Step Forward Records, the Unipride 7-inch.
Yeah.
And do you like that?
No. Was it Step? I think Step Forward was. Boy, so long ago. So it was really kind of weird. We had it released initially in Arizona, and then it came out again with Jason Bush.
It got re-released again a couple years later on Point Blank.
There you go. Yeah. Thanks for correcting that. Yeah. So it initially had 1,000 pressing. That went on to be like this rare can't find record. I don't even have one. And then it went to Jason, and Jason did some kind of strange stuff with some covers and did some limited stuff. And then it disappeared and then popped up as a CD out of Germany, with, thanks to Corey Sabatini selling it off to, as he was the singer on the record, which he was not. And then eventually we released the demo and the record together on Mankind with Igby.
Were you at least,
which is nice.
Yeah, no, it's super rad, and people can find it still. It's on Mankind Records. Everyone get that. But was there like a little sense of pride getting bootlegged by Lost and Found, or was that like in the time when everyone kind of hated them?
Well, I will tell you this. I joined the Marine Corps in 1991 and went away. And I was in a high school punk band. We put out a 7-inch, and then we disappeared. And then I went away and was totally checked out from everything at that point. And then when I came back, I found out that like people were listening to us like all over the place, like in Europe and all kinds of stuff. And I was like, what in the hell is this? It turns out that that first pressing, the hard to get 1,000 press, was now going for like $100 back in the early 90s. And so I think, at least this is my theory, is that, you know, with a lot of bands that have hard to get records, they become more popular that way and people want to hear them. And so people started hearing about them, and it became this sort of hard to get thing, and people are trying to get it. So I think eventually we sort of became a little bit more popularized by that happening. But nonetheless, then Corey, you know, sells it off at the same time to have it put out on CD. And so now it's bootlegged and people are getting it. And so now people are hearing it. And so I was thinking, one, I was super pissed at Corey for many years. And, you know, the idea was, well, it's out, so at least people are hearing it. So I guess that's a good thing. And it turned out to be a really good thing. So in some ways, he did us a favor. You know, he also did Redemption 87 a favor, because people were really interested in the band because I was from Unipride.
Sure. It plays right into that. Let's just step back, though, a minute and talk about Unipride a bit. When you come into your own sound and, you know, you're doing the straight edge hardcore thing, does the popularity, what is the popularity of the band, and like, where are you playing on bills, and how's it going for the band?
So as we were coming up, we were very fortunate that, Tim Yohannan from Gilman Street, who ran the whole thing, who started it all, was a fan of ours. Like, he liked our band. I don't know if he liked us or if he liked the band or both or what, but by some miracle, it seems like he actually liked us, and he would put us on all these really good bills. So whenever I would call him, you know, he'd say, I have this show. If you want it, I'd like to put you on it. And we're like, okay, what's that? You know, our first show was with Blast. And for me, as a Blast fan, that was like, blew my mind, you know, like, they were not very loved at that point. And I think that there was some incident that happened back then, but for us, we were big fans of the Power of Expression album. And that was huge. And so that was a packed show. And so a lot of people saw us. And if a lot of people see you in the Gilman Street community, you know, I think a lot of people will just come back and see you again. You know, you didn't have to be the greatest band in the world to have people come and see you. You know, and I think we were good enough to have people really actually like us for what we were doing. And, you know, we had our own little contingency from the Valley that kind of followed us because they were all our friends. And, you know, it was pretty good because we would have people come out and see us whenever we played, and we kind of rose up on the bills. I think the highest we ever made it during our time was like to the 3 slot on a 5 band bill. But, you know, we played all the shows that Youth of Today played after 1987 until 1989 when we broke up. And, you know, we played a lot of California shows where it was like Unit Pride, Hard Stance, No for an Answer, Instead, you know, Verbal Assault at one time played. I feel like I'm forgetting somebody. But there was like this constant of like this No for an Answer, Instead, Hard Stance kind of would come up and that kind of thing. But yeah, I mean, it was pretty cool like that. Oh, and our Operation Ivy shows, I think actually those are probably the biggest ones, because Operation Ivy put us on, it would have to be like at least 50% of their shows at Gilman Street. And they were the biggest band.
Yeah, that's such an awesome mixed bill. Because like by the 7-inch, Unit Pride is playing like, it's really intense. I mean, it's like scissor beat, straight edge hardcore. Like you're going for the full-on fast beat, and to be playing with Op Ivy, it's completely the opposite, you know?
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. Gilman Street was so great because it merged all of these different styles. So it really brought, you know, if you were into like hardcore and you came and you saw this like weird ska punk band, or you saw like some sort of rockabilly punk thing going on, like, you know, there was all kinds of stuff going on. I mean, we played with the Beatniks, and that's what's the name of his band? I'll never forget. But anyway, they were crazy. They had stuff up there. They were like banging on metal and like making all kinds of sounds with like saws. And I mean, it was just like the weirdest stuff that you would never put us with. And, yeah, I mean, you had all kinds of stuff going on in there, and they merged all these shows. No, there was no like, I shouldn't say that. They did have shows that seemed to be more themed. Like when we played with the No for an Answer, Instead, Hard Stand shows, those, you know, they would Breakaway would be on there, formerly Rabid Lassie. And, you know, they would be on all those shows, and we all kind of sounded the same. But mostly you got stuck on some random bill playing with like, you know, random stuff. And so you would get all these people who were coming to see the one band, like the Yeasty Girls, you know, and they would see Unit Pride, you know, and then actually like them because they were just sort of forced to watch them, you know, like that kind of thing. And it's like, I never knew I liked this kind of music, you know, because I've only been listening to this. But it was also a smaller world back then where there wasn't a lot, there wasn't like a ton to like pick from, right? So you kind of like in the 80s, whatever was thrown your way, mostly it stuck. Mostly it stuck. And you would just listen to it. And it would just be part of a mixtape that we'd just keep listening to. And if they came, you knew the band. You're like, I know that band. I'm going to go see them, you know. Because it'd be a place to hang out.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know? it's a full pre-internet phenomenon, right?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I should even say pre-high-speed internet, you know, where you just have, you have limited resources of what you can access, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So does the ending of Unit Pride, that coincides with you going into the Marines, or are they two separate things?
they were separate. So I quit Unit Pride in 89. They went on a tour that year in the summer because it was already booked when I quit. And, you know, I said, have Corey sing. Corey's the one that sold off the record. He was our roadie and a really good friend of mine at the time. So they went on the tour, but that was pretty much it. I think they played maybe one local show, but they didn't record and they didn't do anything, but they did tour. So a lot of people over the years have been like, I saw you on the East Coast when I was like 10, you know, I'm like, that wasn't me. Yeah. But yeah. So I was off in my own headspace trying to kind of balance out my act by, you know, finishing high school with an actual diploma rather than failing, because I was putting everything I had into like music and skateboarding and that kind of stuff. And, so I did that and went back. I had to do an extra year of high school. And then when I got out, I was like, I don't know what I'm doing anymore. And I really wasn't hanging out with anybody because I'd sort of pushed everybody away and, you know, just impulsively for a lot of reasons joined the Marine Corps, and I no longer had to live in the house that I grew up in, which was fine, you know. But the Marine Corps was interesting because as I pushed everybody away and sort of gotten away from hardcore and punk and all of that, we're trying to stay focused on like school and stuff, I now was sort of lost. And what happened to me in the Marine Corps when I was in the Philippines was somebody was from Benicia, California, and they were in like another platoon. And he's like, oh, dude, I know you like Operation Ivy. And I was like, oh, yeah, I used to play with them when I was in this band. And he handed me their tape. And I didn't have any of this stuff with me, right? So I got that tape and I started listening to it, and it totally brought me back. I started reading Jesse's lyrics, and it just brought me back to like who I was and sort of rebooted my head. And that's why I have this Operation Ivy tattoo that I got in the Marines, was to remind me of who I was. And so as soon as I got back to Hawaii, where I was stationed, you know, I started buying up records and things like that. And when I went home on leave, I went and saw Tim Armstrong and Grant from Unit Pride, and we were hanging out and like sort of rekindling stuff. And I started connecting with people. So when I did get out, I immediately slotted right back into all my old friends and the music scene. And then it was like maybe 6 months after I got out or something like that, where I started Redemption 87. But there was one of those mysterious bands that I started before that called Potter's Field. We only played like 3 shows and never recorded anything, but it was like I don't even know how to classify it, to be honest with you. You know, it was a lot of really screaming kind of stuff. It didn't even sound like what I do now, but ultimately I was still listening to hardcore when I got back and really wanted to do that. I ran into people that way, and we just kind of put the band together. But you're probably still wanting to talk about Unit Pride.
we can move on from Unit Pride, and if people have more on that, they can send questions and we can do a follow-up. But what I want to know is how did your personality mesh into, like, because it seems like you had a pretty loose life. Like if your parents weren't super strict on you, and then you're in the punk scene, and then you go into something like the Marines, like how did you adapt to like the rigidness of that?
I didn't. I was always getting in trouble. Kind of trying to do it my own way. You know, like there's a certain level of you have to adapt in order to be in the military, period. And, you know, there's kind of like the brainwashed version where you become it. And there's kind of the version where you show up and you're like, whoa, this totally sucks. Or, you know, like this is not me. And you just don't conform, and you kind of fall in line here, but not over here. And it's kind of like I was doing that. I definitely found myself really good at all the physical stuff and actually enjoyed like doing that because I always like that kind of physical challenge. But a lot of the like yes sir, no sir, kind of like, you know, the structure of it, the chain of command and having to talk to this person before you can talk to that person, I was no good at that and always was getting in trouble. One of my platoon sergeants nicknamed me Leapfrog because I was always jumping the chain of command and going to people above him to get information, because information is like gold in the military, because no one tells you anything if you're on the lower level of things, right? So I was always bouncing around and networking with people and got to know people and be like, hey, so what's up with this? And I'd find out and come back and tell everybody. And then I'd get totally in trouble for like jumping the chain of command. And, you know, then they would put me on some crappy duty, like fire watch, or I got shoved in the kitchen a bunch of times. I was not the best. I was not the best Marine out there. there was a bunch of us that all served in the Marine Corps in Hawaii. Guy Jim from Chicago, Dewey from Colorado or Montana. He was like from both places. Brick, who was from Texas, and then Pete, who was from Florida. And we all used to hang out. Owen Taylor, who was from Northern California up in the Santa Rosa area. And we all would hang out and just totally, I mean, we'd listen to like punk rock, and like I got into being a vegan in the military when I was in Japan. And so I was cooking vegan stuff like illegally in the barracks with a hot plate. And we were just like moshing and throwing shit at each other all the time. It was like a ritual that we had, and we called it the fan club. And it was just like our little punk rock getaway, you know, just being there and just being totally shitty and just screwing around doing stuff we couldn't do otherwise.
With being so into skateboarding, did you ever bother to try to get into surfing when you lived in Hawaii?
No, I'm not a fan of sharks.
Yeah, me either. They're fucking scary, dude.
They are.
They're
very scary.
They're real life monsters.
They really are. They really are. I mean, I'll be honest with you. I do love them from a distance. Like watching them, I think they're incredible, right? Like that's an incredible, you know, creature to have on this planet because it's so different from us. But I do not want to be in a water with them when I am their food potentially, right?
Yeah.
And my dad took me to see Jaws when I was 5. And I ran out of the theater screaming at the first, like, you know, shark attack. And, you know, it just ruined me for sharks in the water.
Yeah. So, well, also NorCal, I mean, you have the Farallon Islands right out there, which is like the Mecca. I read a whole book on it.
Yeah. It's like the Red Triangle, right?
Yeah. 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 That, yeah. Yeah. But anyway,
yeah, moving on. Not down.
I feel you. Starting Redemption 87, what was like the goal of the band? What was like the mission statement?
It was essentially, I mean, I think a lot of us, one, wanted to play, and two, when we talked about playing, you know, we were all really into the sort of like 1980s version of hardcore. And in the early 90s, as you know, things had shifted quite a bit. A lot of metal was merged with hardcore, I think Agnostic Front was one of the first kind of bands to do that I remember. And then things sort of trickled out of that judge, and things just got more tuned down to D and became a whole different version of hardcore. And I was like, what the hell is this? Because I had checked out and then come back, and then I came back and walked into, you know, all kinds of Earth Crisis, Strife, Snapcase, like, you know, and I'm going, what is this? This isn't even like what I know. And that's fine that they're playing that stuff. But at the time, being like a 24-year-old, you know, I was like, nah, screw that. You know, we got to do it. Like, keep it real, you know? So I was like throwing down with like the old school version of hardcore. And of course, in Northern California, there wasn't really any hardcore going on until, you know, Joey and his band and Don, they were in Breakaway. And Don actually played in Unit Pride as well for a little while. But they were in Breakaway. And then when I got out, they were doing this band Second Coming. And so they were playing hardcore. And Powerhouse, we learned, was this band from Oakland. And they were playing hardcore. And so we started to find that there was other hardcore bands around the hoods from the Sacramento area. And, you know, just those bands, I think, were kind of like more in the vein of the earlier 80s kind of hardcore at the time. Like, you know, the early demos, that kind of stuff. I think a few of them have shifted a little bit over time. But we were really into like sort of having this 80s hardcore, early fast style hardcore that was very different than what was going on. So that was kind of it. And that's what Redemption 87 is about. The actual name was to sort of bring back that hardcore from that time, 1987 being like a very particular year for me, and learning about all that stuff and having it be such a point in time. But yeah, I mean, that's what it was. And some people, you know, didn't like that. And then, you know, that was fine, whatever. I think there was a lot of people who really, really liked that idea of like keeping, not necessarily keeping it a certain way, because it wasn't like you were going to get rid of the other bands playing the other ways, but you had certainly a lot of bands who were playing in that sort of style. You know, we eventually would meet up with Ignite, and then, you know, we had all kinds of bands like Trial was up in the Seattle area. So there was bands out there doing this stuff, you know, and we're really down with it. So I think we all kind of like sort of rallied around that and sort of felt like we needed to keep it alive, I guess, is how I should probably put it. But yeah, I think we did a good job of all these bands coming together and really making a 90s version scene out of that. Yeah.
Is the first song that Redemption 87 puts out the About Face song on the Indecision Records Guilty by Association comp? Or you have a demo that comes out around the same time?
We had a demo that I think that song came from.
Okay.
Or that. So the About Face on the New Age Guilty by Association. Is it New Age, right?
Indecision.
Yeah.
Indecision.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Because it's okay. So that song comes from that demo.
Yeah, and so it's such a standout track on that record. Like, that's a lot of people, you know, they're like, fucking A, that Redemption 87 song on that comp, like, you know, just hits you in the face, you know, and I think that's like kind of a blow up point. You know, comps they're more important at that time. Like, I interviewed Andrew from Strife, and he talks about Strife really getting popular off a couple compilation songs, you know, and I think maybe for you guys, it's kind of the same way, at least outside of your, you know, your hometown area, you know, because that song does stand out. I mean, my favorite song of all time is also on that record, the Collateral Damage song. You tell me to hold.
Oh, I love it.
You know,
yeah.
That's what rips. But About Face, very close second, you know.
Yeah, I don't think it even compares with Chris's song. You know, that band was so great at that time. You know, we played a lot of shit. So one of the things I should probably talk about is that during this time, I connected with Mike Hartsfield, and he knew everybody down there. And, you know, I had known a lot of people up in the Bay Area, particularly from, you know, the 80s and the punk scene and that kind of stuff. So I had suddenly, right off the bat, two huge networks to tap into. So I was learning about all these bands, whether I liked them or not. I actually welcomed everybody to play together, much like how Gilman Street did. You didn't have to sound exactly the same to play together. Just put anybody on the bill as long as they're willing to come up from Southern California, or, you know, want to be on the bill from Northern California or wherever you're coming from. And so a lot of the shows at that time, we started doing these Sunday matinee shows at the Berkeley Square, because I had asked for that day, because I was putting up flyers for the Berkeley Square and like cleaning their bathrooms, and working with the owner, Omar, and the booking agent, AJ Cardinal, who became a longtime friend of mine. And those matinees were something else. And a lot of people make fun of me for them, because sometimes I would load down the bills with like way too many bands. But I wanted everybody to play. I wanted everybody to see these hardcore bands, because there wasn't a lot of hardcore in the Bay Area. And so I would bring up, you know, bands like the Suppression Swing, Triceratops, Collateral Damage, Trial would come in and play like West Coast stuff. We would have like Ensign would come over from New Jersey when they were on tour. We had Hatebreed at one point early on in their time. You know, Ignite would play a lot of shows. We would play a lot of shows. AFI would play a lot of shows back in their early days. And like Model American or Rely was one of the bands that was playing like tons of shows. And it was just really about giving everybody a chance to show up and play. And it was really just about, let's have a hardcore scene. You know, and it didn't matter if you sounded like the Suppression Swing or Trial or AFI or whoever. It was just like, let's create something. And we did. You know, Powerhouse was great. They knew a lot of people. They played a lot of those shows. You know, Hoods, Mikey Hood, very connected. You know, Pressure Point out of Sacramento. There was so many bands that come through and just play consistently through there.
Yeah, it's very eclectic.
Great time.
Very eclectic.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
So going into the first Redemption 87 LP, what's the songwriting process like? Do you write the whole LP, or is it just you're writing song by song and then you have enough and you go do an LP? Is there a direction or not?
No, I think it's just more, when we were writing songs, we'd show up, we'd have parts, put together the parts, you know, come up with the song. As soon as the song was sort of together for the most part, then I would go away and put lyrics on it. And it was never like, this song's going to be about this. It would just be about feeling. So every song, essentially, I would just feel into it. And then, you know, by that, I would get a vibe of like what I was feeling, like what was coming up for me in that, you know, the very kind of like an intuitive kind of process. And I would just start writing. And I would write stuff, and then some stuff would stick and some stuff would not. And maybe I'd write a whole song and scrap it because it just didn't feel right. It had to feel absolutely right. It wasn't like, I need to write about this, you know?
Sure.
Like it was just like, what is coming up? What feels right to this song? Because it's really that music is going to be the undercurrent for whatever I'm saying. So it has to sort of jive together, you know, and that's what happened. I look back on that stuff and, you know, a lot of it feels right to me. Some of it is like, maybe that's kind of a weird choice for that music, you know, but it might've just been where my head was at that day and just felt right.
Do you remember anything about the recording process of this LP?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Now, for the record, which is such a great place to be at. And I can't remember if Paul Miner did that record or not. I don't have like them out in front of me, but
Craig Knepp.
Oh, that's right. That was Craig. Yeah, because Paul did our Nerve Agent self-titled when we were down there, and I think he did some stuff right after that for our split. But anyway, yeah, for the record experience was, I mean, it was fun. It was interesting. You know, it's nice to look back on. I mean, Timmy Chunks was there. He wasn't always there because he was out on tour quite a bit. You know, he was working with Green Day at the time and all over the damn place. So sometimes we'd have him and sometimes we wouldn't. And so it was always nice to have him around because it made the band feel full and like that was it, you know. That was really probably the first true recording I'd done, other than the Unit Pride one back in San Francisco in like 1988. But this was like a full album. And, you know, it was where I kind of learned how to do things in the studio, which probably doesn't even make sense if I say it, but it's like I had to, because I'm such an aggressive singer, like I had to be holding on to something as if it was a microphone, so that I can like have that sort of feeling. I couldn't just stand there and scream into the mic, but I had to, but I couldn't. So there was kind of this interesting balance that came out of that. You know, of course my voice would go out all the time because I would be doing take after take after take until I didn't screw things up or whatever. But, what I learned is I needed to drink a lot of tea with honey and lemon at the time. And so that was kind of an interesting process. But one of the things that's notable from that particular recording was that the Antidote song, Something Must Be Done, you know, we had plugged it into like, I don't know what kind of amp it was, but it was like a guitar amp, and they recorded it through that, because it came out on the record as if it was like an old record. You know, like we wanted to have a really raw, kind of like scratchy feel to it, you know, so it sounds like it's being played through a speaker when you listen to it, and that's really what was happening.
What did you do for the microphone compromise, like with you wanting to hold something? Because that's specifically what I was thinking about, is because your voice is so wild. I was like, how's he standing into place when he's doing this? Like now they have stuff where you can like, you know, hold a microphone and move around. But then,
I couldn't do that.
Yeah, then for sure it's like a static thing that you have to stand in front of and you can't change your distance and so forth.
No, you couldn't. So that was where I had to learn. I guess that's what I'm talking about, is I had to learn to move my body not in the full ways where like I was playing live, but in a way where I could bring the intensity out of like my physical being, but also keep my head and my mouth sort of in that spot when I had to say something. And then when I didn't, I was able to bounce back, or, you know what I mean? And so I ended up, a drumstick is usually what I would hold. That's what I sort of came to, because it's hard and I could grip it like a mic in a way where I, you know, was very unlikely to break it. But, cause it was that intense. I mean, it was, you know, it's very aggro stuff that I'm putting out in the studio where you got to be stationary. So.
Sure. Yeah. Like I've always held like the, you know, the paper or something. And it's like, yeah, when you get done singing, it's like, okay, I'm holding like a piece of tissue, cause you've like worked it down so much by folding it and gripping it, you know?
Yeah. No, I think that, you know, having the lyrics, a lot of times when you when you bring a song to the studio that you haven't remembered the lyrics and you're having to read them off the paper. Like, I've done that before, but eventually you quickly learn the song because you're doing it so much. But I could never hold paper. It just wouldn't work. And I think holding a mic stand was too weighty at the bottom, so that never worked. But just having to kind of work that out. And it became kind of a staple for me over the all the various recordings that I did have, where I would hold a drumstick and drink tea. You know, I had, you know, at the time, we had, and this, I think this is more in the Nerve Agents. I don't think it started in Redemption 87, but in the studio, you know, we'd have somebody who would be designated my tea bitch is what we called them. And it's probably not appropriate at this point in time, but
very 90s.
Yes, very 90s. But having somebody who was designated as to be on call for tea at all times, couldn't leave the studio, had to like come in and out of the studio and have my tea hot, because I had to have it hot so that I could get my voice out of the next take when it started to go. And, it was just like a whole thing. So that became like a staple thing for whenever I recorded, I had to have somebody sort of there with me from the band or something who was doing that.
How did it feel to have this album be out? Because, you know, hardcore band, lots of bands do demos, many bands do 7 inches, but, you know, seminal hardcore bands put out LPs. And here's your first one after you've been in hardcore 10 plus years at this point. You finally have it in your hand. How does that feel?
You know, I think it was awesome. I don't know that I can remember how I felt about it, but I know for a fact that I did really like having an album. Now, that was really cool. I'm always big on like the packaging of the album. And so I was really, so Dayton Paiva, who has been around since the Unit Pride days and went to high school same time as me and all the other guys. He was part of our San Ramon crew with Unit Pride and Breakaway. And he's a photographer who you would see on every band of mine. There's Dayton Paiva photos, except Said Radio, which doesn't have any photos. But he's been around taking photos of bands forever now, since the 80s. And he's, you know, he's got these great shots that he took. So many of them are from him on that Redemption 87 first album, the self-titled. And that shot on the front of me, not because it's of me, but just because I love photography. And that shot is so great, of me jumping out into the crowd at the Fillmore. And there's somebody down below, this one woman who used to come to our shows. She's older woman in the front, and she used to dance all the time. She's lighting a cigarette, and I'm about to land on her head. So awesome. It's such a great shot. But I just remember looking at that and always picking it up and holding it and just really loving the fact that this was the album. Like, this is what it looked like, you know?
Yeah. It's so iconic. I mean, half the sales just had to be based on like that album cover. I can't imagine. Like,
I would have bought it.
Hell yeah. You know, you see it at stores. It's like, please take my money. You know? But
yeah.
How does the popularity of the band do once this record comes out?
Oh, it definitely went up. I mean, you know, anytime you have, you can put something out like that. So keeping in mind that the Spidey Sessions demo that came out before it was just a demo, right? It was not like an actual record. So, you know, people were still playing cassette tapes back then, but, you know, it's just a different thing when you have an album that's in stores and it's going all over the place and people are getting it. Whereas your demo, unless you're touring all the time, which we were not, doesn't really go everywhere. So when that came out, it did. We blew up, and it was super helpful to have. And people on the East Coast got it, and we got a lot of praise for that album. People really, I think, took to it. So it was nice to be loved, right? You know.
Yeah, I mean, nice. It's a very unique album. I mean, you hit so many different tempos, and like while it does have that the old school vibe, like a lot of it is a more drivey, like an up tempo, mid tempo. You know, more so, mm-hmm. You do have somewhere you go to the scissor beat, but it's not the standout stuff. The standout stuff is like sometimes when you're not even fast. And it's like, what is this? You know, it sounds like really like nothing before it or after it. I absolutely love it.
I'm glad you like it. You make a good point. Here we are after like this, like classic hardcore sound. And we weren't really even playing it so much on most of those songs. And a lot of that has to do with, I think, Ian and Kimmy Chunks and even like Scotty. Well, actually, and Gary. So let me kind of point out these guys, right? So Ian was in Skank and Pickle at the time, which is like a ska band, right? Like a 90s ska band who was a really popular band. And Gary, you know, he grew up in the 70s listening to all of the like, early punk stuff and, you know, some of the like more punk / rock stuff that's out there that, you know, is really cool and hip to listen to. And, you know, not a hardcore guy at all. I had to feed him tapes so that he understood like what we were doing. and he totally took to it and loved it. But, Timmy Chunks, you know, he was in Token Entry. You know, he's very big on like 7 Seconds and stuff like that, but I don't know that he was like a Youth Crew guy at all, you know? And Scotty was very much like a Rancid prodigy kind of kid. You know, he grew up in the Bay Area just loving Rancid. And, you know, he was playing more in lines with what maybe they were doing in his other band. So I was probably the only one truly coming in like in this very hardcore focused way. But at the same time, you know, I was driving a lot of it. And I think Timmy and Ian, who both grew up in hardcore, but just not maybe as well. Ian was pretty much like a Youth Crew kind of guy, but I think he grew up in Louisiana and was listening to same stuff as me, but also some different stuff. And then sort of gravitated. He's big on music, so he's listened to a lot of things that influenced him. But it shows on that record, right?
Absolutely.
It's not just Antidote or Youth of Today-esque stuff. It's, you know, it's all over the place.
Yes, it's not falling into a formula at all. It is super, super right? rad.
Yeah.
Do you remember any standout shows from this era?
Well,
I know, it's hard.
Yeah. There were some. One of my favorites was a show at the Berkeley Square where we played with AFI, and we were both at that time headliners, but they by far were more of a headliner than us, so they of course played over us, but we played right underneath them. And one of the things that Davey and I, Davey from AFI, singer, we really appreciated each other's stage presence. So playing with them always like made me feel like this more intensity. It was almost like the show quality just brought the intensity out because AFI was going to play and they're like high intensity show as well. Right. So playing, like I just played at this high intensity, like I normally do, but there's this little extra push because AFI is playing that night. It's just, was in my blood, I guess. But it's so funny because I remember coming off the stage and Dave going, oh, great. Now I got to follow that. And he went out there and he just like totally killed it. It was just awesome. And it was just such a great show because the intensity was so high. And it was just like this, such a fun show because at that time, as I was saying before, so we were building like up a hardcore scene, and here we were with all of these people that just felt like one big kind of community, one big family. And it's just really great. You know, I think other than that, I mean, I would say playing the Fillmore with Rancid and AFI, you know, is just kind of a mind-blowing experience to play something that big when you've never done it before. You know, and the place was sold out and it was like 1,000 capacity or something like that. And, you know, I'd never played anything like that. And all the shows that I went to were generally in the like 300 to 500 capacity. So I was just kind of like this sea of people, and it just was great for us. We played really great. It was a great show. It was the one on the cover of the self-titled. And Rancid was great. AFI was great. So that definitely stands out.
How do you... go ahead. Sorry.
No, I was going to say one other one that stands out is I used to quit the band all the time. And so I think it was our second last show. we had three last shows for Redemption 87. And I think it was our second last show. We played the Berkeley Square, and I was wearing like my A's jersey. And I remember Sammy the Mick, who's now gone and passed away. And he was there. And I just remember like the presence of so many people that are no longer around, like Sammy and Tim Mazingo and, you know, Ernie was there. And I mean, it's a lot of people. So it was one big love fest, because everybody who was a Redemption 87 fan, which were a lot of people at that point, this was like late 96 or early 97. It was a lot of people, and it was just everybody showing up and sort of pouring out everything, because everybody knew it was the last show. You know, and that's just such an amazing experience to have. You know, we then got back together in 97 for a short time and had another last show. and then we had a reunion show in 2004. But that was such a great show.
I think I came up, well, I definitely came up for one of the last shows. I think it was at, I think Slim's, is that right? It was like,
yeah, that would.
Okay.
Yeah, that would probably be our last show.
Oh, all right. Sick.
Yeah.
So yeah,
I can't remember what the last show was like, but I think you're right. I think it was a Slim.
Yeah. Super rad.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
When do you record the All Guns Poolside? Are you still a band, or do you record it after you break up?
You're calling me out. You know, I can't remember I think we recorded that after we got back together.
Okay. So like between one of the last shows.
Because the second to last show photos are on that.
Okay.
So we'd broken up, and that was brief, and we got back together. And so I think we did this album, and you know, if you have the insert to that album, it has a lot of the flyers from those shows and pictures from a lot of those shows. And yeah, I mean, that was a hellish experience for me, that the recording of that album. And I think it shows. It's by far the album I dislike the most, which some people tell me it's like their favorite album. I'm like, what are you talking about? You sound like a parrot, you know?
Well, but, you know, it's kind of weird. It's some of the 90s bands that just put out CD and it doesn't come out on LP, it kind of gets a little lost to history. And I think this is one of them. I do think it's very good. Maybe not as unique as the first one. And this is super nerdy, but I think it's a little bit of the first one. The guitar tone is kind of thin in a way, but in a good way. Mm-hmm. And this one is like a more regular guitar tone. So it the sound changes a tad bit, even though the songwriting is all the same. And I think one of your best songs, that How Can We Hide song, is on this. There was also on a comp that came out. So it's a rad record, but why was it so hellish?
My voice went out right off the bat. And so it was just really a miserable experience to try and record it. And, you know, I'm sure you've you've experienced other bands who put out maybe like five albums and one of them you're like, what's up with that dude's voice? Or, you know, I mean, it's that kind of album for me where like it just doesn't work the same. I don't think that the production was really how I would like it. And I just don't like the sound of it, I guess. But I do love some of the songs. Like How Can We Hide? Great song. You know? I think that The Plague, I really love that song. You know, there's just a lot of stuff that it just didn't go well for me all around on that thing. And I think it also comes from kind of the band really not in the best space, which is why we ended up like not being kind of together around it as much. You know, I love the fact that Jade's on that album. You know, Jade is, you know, on there playing guitar, and you know, I love that because he was a big part of the band, and so I'm glad that that came up. But yeah, I mean, there's some good songs on it, but it's just, you know, I think there's only like a total of maybe seven songs. It should have been more of like a, you know, sort of like extended play kind of deal where it's like the first Nerve Agents self-titled one where it had like eight songs or something. Sure. But we added all these covers. You know, we did like the Negative Approach song, Tied Down, Big Takeover, Bad Brain song, and Hard Times of the Cro-Mags, and we threw our demo in there, demo songs. And you know, it's just kind of a weird eclectic kind of thrown together thing, and I think it really just kind of feels that way to me overall.
It's, you know, very of the time trying to like load up a CD, right? Because it's like, well, you have this much space, let's just toss out everything. But yeah, then it does like take away from the project a tad. The last thing that I wanted to highlight of this era is with you talking about like the unity and all these different bands getting along. There's some seminal Northern California hardcore comps that come out in these years. One that you do, the 10 Years Later comp, which I believe put out, right? The Bossa Nova Records.
I did, yeah.
Yeah, that one's rad. Also, the California Call to Arms.
Thanks.
That one's super cool.
Okay, yeah.
That one's on Breakout and Gain Ground. And then my favorite of them all was that Our Own Way comp that came out. I think it's a Blackout. Yeah, Blackout Records. And you're on all those, and they're super sick. Although the Our Own Way is not necessarily NorCal, but you guys are on it. Model American is on it, and some other bands, I believe. Powerhouse does Fence Walker, one of their best songs. But how did it feel to put together like a comp representing? I think it's mostly, no, I guess it's all over the place too.
It's all over the place.
Yeah,
it's, you know what it is. It's a product of my networking. it's got random stuff on there. You know, it's got like a Down by Law cover.
Sure,
you know. It's got Rancid doing a Sick of It All song. Got some like bands from Canada on there. You know, like there's a handful of East Coast bands, but yeah, definitely a lot of local bands, just because those are the bands that I was around a lot. You know, got all, you know, Hoods and Powerhouse and Second Coming and Model American and Rely. You know. Those are kind of like the main bands. There's some just really wild stuff. I think 7 Seconds is on there. And yep. Yeah, I mean, but just, it doesn't necessarily as an album flow kind of like, you know what I mean? Like there's no real theme to it. It's just like all these bands and, to me, all those bands were great. I loved it. I put that thing together and was like, this is awesome. You know, like,
yeah.
It's like making a mixtape back then, yeah. Where you're like, this is the best mixtape. That's exactly what happened.
Yeah, it's half, you know? It's half mixtape, half Rolodex.
That's pretty much it. It's a great way of putting it.
Yeah. Let's talk about getting the nerve agents together. What is the, how does this come together? It's a molding of you plus like a couple of the Model American guys, right? But but what's the goal of the band and like what's the mission statement?
Andy Granelic, the drummer of the Nerve Agents, used to come to Redemption 87 shows. By the way, now that I just said that, I'm thinking of this one show that was the Trocadero in San Francisco used to do these amazing free shows with like AFI, Swingin' Utters, Screw 32, Redemption 87. And there was like two of them that we played. And those were the most incredible shows. I can't believe I forgot those. Anyway.
Is that the club that was across the street from the Lusty Lady?
No, that's the Cocodrie.
The Cocodrie. Okay, I got them mixed.
Yeah, yeah. No, Trocadero is... I don't even know how to describe where it's at.
Yeah, and
it's right off the freeway, kind of almost under the western side of the Bay Bridge where you would pop out into San Francisco. It's only a few blocks from the on-ramp to get on right there.
Oh, fair enough.
Yeah. Anyway, that closed down right probably in like 96 or 97. Okay. Anyway, off topic. So Andy's at the Trocadero, and I remember him giving me like the Model American demo tape, something like that from the crowd. And I remember listening to it, and I ended up calling him and telling him how much I liked it. And then I put him on shows. Well, Tim and Andy were fans of Redemption 87. And Andy, as he started to know me more, would be like, "Hey, dude, when are we going to start a band?" You know, I'd be like, "Yeah, whatever." Right. You know, "I'm going to start a band. I'm in a band." Right. And eventually, after Redemption 87 broke up, and I was at Gilman Street one night watching some show. And I remember sitting back and just really feeling like there was a huge void, like something was missing. And it just, yeah, I don't know if it was like the intensity of the show I was watching was just like missing that. This was a huge show too for the time. Like, and I'm not sure who was playing it. It might have been All Bets Off. But I remember thinking, I need to start another band. You know, I need to start another band and put something on the table because, like, I really want something to be more intense, you know, like I was really hoping to bring something back that seemed to be missing to me. Right. And so I walked out the door and I said, "Hey, Andy, you still want to start that band?" And he's like, "What? Yeah." And I was like, "Okay, you're playing drums. Where's Sweers, who is in Rely?" And I said, "Hey, Sweers, you want to start a band?" And he was going to play bass, which he did. And then I said, "I'll talk to my roommate, Kevin, who was in Goodfellas." And, you know, I hang out with him quite a bit. So he played guitar and that was it. We suddenly had a band. And so we just got to it. And then soon after, Andy was like, "Hey, man, Tim really wants to be in this band. You should really have Tim in this band." And I was like, "Tim doesn't even know how to play guitar. He just sings." He's like, "No, dude, he just learned." I was like, "Are you kidding me?" He's like, "No, he's been playing for like 6 months. He's really good. Just give him a chance." And so I was like, "All right, whatever." So brought him in and he was actually good. So he was in the band, which thank God, because, you know, the Nerve Agents without Tim would be like, I don't know, like the Rolling Stones without Keith Richards or something, like, you know, sure. Like that kind of thing. But yeah, so we started this band and I was planning on moving to Los Angeles in 6 months. So I said, "We're doing this band for 6 months and we're going to play as many shows as we can and we're going to put out a record." And they're like, "What?" And I was like, totally full of myself. I'm like, "I can do this. I know I can get us a record. Somebody's going to give us a record and I can get a show. That's no problem." Cause I was booking shows and I knew all these people to book shows. So that was easy. And suddenly we had all these shows, and we got Brett Matthews, who had Cold Front Records, and he was totally down for putting out an album. Like, look at that. We're already doing it. And they're like, whoa. So we just moved forward. We played shows. We played our first show at Bottom of the Hill with Sweers, and then Sweers quit, which was really interesting. He quit because of a relationship, which was kind of bizarre. But we eventually had Kevin play bass and Tim was playing guitar. And so we got Dante eventually. But we put out the self-titled first, after we were playing some shows, and then we recorded. So we recorded for Cold Front Records the self-titled that you know from Revelation. And as soon as, so Paul Miner recorded it for the record. And to me, that was a really good recording. I really liked it. It's like ideal for me, at least. And he took it to Revelation, and apparently Jordan heard it and wanted to sign us, like right after hearing it. And he called me, Paul called me, and was like, hey, Revelation wants to sign you. And I was like, what? He's like, yeah, do you think you could get out of this record deal and use this record? I was like, oh my God. And on one hand, like my hardcore dream was to be on Revelation, right? Because that's, I grew up selling Revelation records out of a bag to my high school friends, you know, for Jordan and Ray. And so here I was, like, poised to get on this record label that had every one of, like, my foundational favorite bands, right? And yet, the guy who paid for the recording was from a record label who was putting out the record. So I called Brett and I was like, look, Brett, let me just explain what's going on here. So I let him know, and he was super bummed because he was very excited about having us do a record for him. He really liked our band. But he understood that, you know, Revelation's a big deal, and he let us go. And so we signed a Revelation, and they put out the self-titled, and that actually did really well right off the bat. They had, they were putting out for each album, like one song they would sample for people before it came out.
Sure.
And, I think they put I Keep Screaming up, and it got a lot of really good comments in the section. I think it was, it was a really good response. So I think people were really interested in this band, but it was also kind of this weird band because it was called the Nerve Agents, which is not your usual hardcore name back then. You know, back then, I mean, you'd be called like Frontline or, you know, like,
sure,
you know, something like that. And so it was a really weird kind of thing that we started off thinking we wanted to play hardcore, but we also wanted to bring in a lot of our early punk elements that Kevin and I were really kind of bonding over because we both grew up, we were the same age, we both grew up on the same early stuff. So this was somebody who was aligned with me and my early like punk, non-youth crew, hardcore stuff. And we were really like getting behind that, you know, Black Flag, Dead Kennedys, like that kind of stuff, right? And Misfits, things like that. And so we were bringing that, fusing that together with the general youth of today, Antidote, you know, that kind of stuff. And when we did that, we ended up with the Nerve Agents, which was a little bit more, it wasn't dark yet because we hadn't hit that point, but it was a little bit more aggressive and sort of, I think, a little bit more attached to our punk roots, what we were doing. And I think that came out in the music, but it also, I think, hits the mark a little bit better for my idea of hardcore than even Redemption 87 did. And I really like the self-titled album for that reason.
You definitely, you lean into like big hooks. I'd say like maybe that's what it satisfies. Like it's very, very catchy.
Like well, that's one of the great things about the Nerve Agent is that the musicians in the band, all the way from the self-titled to Zach and Dante, you know, and in the Butterfly Collection, was that everybody's really freaking good at what they're doing. Sure. You know, we have Andy, who's amazing. Tim is, they're all amazing. Like they're all really good. And so they coming together, the chemistry. So it was like this, you know, bringing together really good musicians, but then having the chemistry click was the really the thing. And I feel like I really lucked out because let's be honest, like my vocals is not everybody's cup of tea. I think we just know that. And then understanding that, like, I couldn't hold anything without really damn good musicians behind me. So every band, I've been very fortunate to play with really good musicians. But the Nerve Agents was like a true step up, only because they were so good and the chemistry really clicked in this band. And I think that this band's music was the most fitting to my vocals, if that makes sense.
There's also just a ton of confidence in the vocals, right? Like you know what you're doing at this point.
Oh yeah.
And you have one of the greatest hardcore rhymes of all time when you, I think it's on the second song on the record, when you rhyme destiny with hey, hey. You know, I mean, like that's full confidence. It's like, I'm going to rhyme destiny with hi, hi, like fuck, you know, you just lay it down like that. Like everyone pay attention. I got this.
You know, it's funny. It's like, that's really interesting. I've never heard anybody say that, but that what you're getting at right there is what I love so much about what I did, because playing these bands is awesome. But when you're playing in the band and you're honing in on the creative aspects of whatever it is you're doing, whether you're playing guitar or you're singing or whatever, like that's the joy in all of this music, right? Like I got a message, I'm putting it out there, but you know what? I'm doing it creatively with screwing around with my words and like in, I'm not like the best writer of lyrics or anything like that, but like I was playing around with the words. I was playing around with how they sounded, because to me, you know, all this stuff is about creativity. And that's the thing actually that I miss the most about not playing, is the creative aspect of coming together, good musicians with chemistry, and creating a song. And then at the end of the day going, that's fucking awesome.
Yeah, I mean the best at it is like the singer is using his vocals as like the vehicle for the message, but also as an instrument, you know, and
absolutely,
and that's where it is, like on that for
yeah.
sure.
Yeah.
And you guys hit right away. I mean, you're obviously a good band, you're on Revelation. I remember you came to Southern California a ton of times, and it was always, you know, you guys are right out the gate popular. How does that feel to be like embraced so quickly?
I was just so much fun. I mean, that was it. Like it was so much fun. And I think we all really were so grateful and just enjoying the experience. We were having so much fun in those first like year and a half, 2 years, probably first year and a half. Like we were playing the PCH club and the Showcase Theater. Those were so much fun, those shows, you know, and you play the PCH and what is there, like 50 people there, you know, but the place is packed and everybody's just having a great time. And I think just being embraced by Southern California and embraced by Northern California, and then like people just really starting to come out and sort of embrace you everywhere is really fucking awesome. And I think that the Nerve Agents, more than any band, created community wherever they went, wherever we went, there was like a community of people who we knew and who, and I think a lot of bands who tour a lot and really have kind of a following of people have this kind of experience. But one of the great things in the Nerve Agents is that when we played live, the whole idea was that we were throwing it all out there. We were going to put it all down there. And it was really about the energy of the crowd, right? And the energy of the band. And if one of those wasn't working, then it wasn't all that great. You know, because we were missing chords. We were dropping guitars. I was breaking mics. I wasn't singing half the time into the mic, you know, like, so like it has to work in that way. And the great thing was, is that maybe it's the music, maybe it's just meeting people and clicking, but that energy went back and forth. It was reciprocal. And that reciprocity it was like so great. It was just so wonderful. And I think we were having so much fun going to play.
Yeah, in this
band, and we really enjoyed writing with each other too. So that was a bonus.
Sure. And this band, you do make it to the East Coast, because I was talking to Greg Pollard, who does the Where It Went podcast, which chronicles all the Revelation releases. Everyone should check that out.
Yeah.
And he would say that every summer when the Nerve Agents came out, I think you went out three times at least. He said like him and his friends would follow you guys around, like you guys were the Grateful Dead. Yeah. So super, super rad.
Yeah. Oh, so much fun. Yeah. Like on the East Coast was the same kind of deal. Whenever we would show up, we would always be with like a band or two. And then, you know, we would then roll around the East Coast. I remember when we were with the Explosion, we stayed at Damien's house and just outside the city of Philadelphia. And from there, we played every show and then we would drive back at night. And so we would go to DC and then drive back. We'd go to New Jersey, drive back to Philly and drive back. I mean, it was just, and we had the same people coming around to the different shows, you know? And it was just, it was fun. It was a fun time. Like that band was a lot of fun. Within the band, we had our own issues between us at different times, but ultimately, you know, like those guys, you know, we're still talking today at this point, and still enjoy hanging out and talking with one another. So it's good stuff.
Yeah, the second LP, The Days of the White Owl, I think this is considered to be the best Nerve Agents record. Do you feel the same way?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I think so.
And what goes into this one? What changes? I mean, obviously, you're a band now. So, you know, first record is always a little different than the second one, but you guys don't sophomore slump at all. You know, there's very few bands that put out their second record being better than the first. So why do you think that is, and what goes into this?
Yeah. So a couple things. We, at one point when Kevin was still in the band, Dante was now in the band, and we'd start talking about how, and there's one show in particular at the Cocodrie after the Nerve Agents played. We had our self-titled out. People were coming to see us, but there was like a huge sort of like hardcore following, which was the same, you know, same group of people that, you know, were supporting us all along or supported Redemption 87. But one of the things that I was really getting behind in my head was that we weren't bringing out people who were like punks, right? We had just a lot of hardcore stuff going on. So I made an effort to do kind of like the Gilman Street thing, which is like merge the shows again, but this time with all kinds of like different sorts of bands, which kind of threw the sort of hardcore falling off, because here we were just going as a hardcore band and that's who was supporting us because it was so close to the time Redemption 87 was around. So all that was still kind of carrying over. And what I noticed that at this Kokodry show was that a lot of the like punk rock looking kids were kind of being othered and made fun of by some people. And it just, I'd starting to see too many of these kinds of like vibes going down at the shows. So we're talking with Kevin and Tim and I think we were all talking at band practice. So it was all five of us. And, you know, I was telling him about how Mike Ness used to wear like eye black and Kevin Seconds used to wear eye black at their shows. And it was very much like, just like this thing that they did that I thought was really cool. There was no real reason for it other than it was of a different time where things were kind of blended, where hardcore and punk were sort of going hand in hand and everybody just embraced it. So they said, let's do that. And so we ended up going on stage with like eye makeup just to throw off the sort of hardcore vibe that we were carrying around, because we wanted it to be more unifying, I guess. We already had like the hardcore kids showing up to our shows, but we wanted like the punk aspect to be kind of more brought on board with that. And so we just did this really slight thing of wearing eye makeup, and then we just kept doing it. And it was pissing people off. And they're like, what are you doing? We're like, what? You know, we're just wearing eye makeup. And so it was really to sort of call people to their own, like, well, do I hate this band now because they're wearing eye makeup, or are they the same band? Like, so it was more of a challenge to everybody. And at the same time, Dante had joined the band, and he brought in a lot of really dark influences because he had a lot of dark stuff that he listened to. And then Kevin and I were sort of harkening back to a lot of the stuff that we listened to, because we were listening to a lot of stuff now together as a band, and, you know, like TSOL, and, you know, Dante brought in like 45 Grave, and the Dead Kennedys had a really dark aspect to them. We started to like bring in a little bit more Misfits kind of stuff. So we were listening to a lot of this stuff at that time. And so what happens is then the music starts to get influenced in a little bit of a darker way. And with that, Days of the White Owl sort of born, because all of our songs started to become that. Now, at the same time, Kevin ends up out of the band. Zach comes into the band. And then we finish off Days of the White Owl with Zach. So it's interesting, because Kevin starts writing some of the music, and then Zach ends up finishing and writing some of the music. So we've got almost, you know, every member incorporated into Days of the White Owl. But the dark sort of tone of it comes from just at that point, Dante shows up with a whole host of new influences, and that triggers Kevin and I to bring up a lot of ours. I think Tim had a lot too that he listened to as well that was similar to Kevin and I. But that's how that gets kind of influenced that way. And then, of course, the whole vibe just takes off, and Kevin and I are big horror fans, and so that sort of played into some of the like songs and like how like you know, like Jekyll and Hyde is a good example. That title is, you know, I'm using the idea of Jekyll and Hyde, like the movie monster Jekyll and Hyde, or the book I should say, and using that, but then incorporating into like a message that I have in a song. So I'm now starting to bring those kinds of things into what I'm doing, which is a new sort of create a realm I have not entered into at this point, from Unit Pride to Redemption 87 to Nerve Agent. So this was the new piece for me to really start to bring in from you know, the vocals and the lyrics is how I'm using this kind of darker tone and like the horror stuff that we're like now watching tons of horror movies and listening to a lot of darker things. It just so happens that that's what we're then playing is Days of the White Owl. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And also the imagery you go with, right? The cover, but it's a cool twist on it too. Like going with the pink lettering, like not being full dark. It's like the juxtaposition of pink with it being dark is super rad.
Oh yeah. Thanks. Tim was just talking about that a couple weeks ago. We were talking about Days of the White Owl, and he was talking about how important that pink was during the time, because nobody really had pink in like the kinds of stuff that we were doing. So it was really sort of sending this more feminine message that also sort of plays in the same way the eye makeup does. And it really challenges some of the, you know, there's sort of a toxic masculinity that comes in the sort of hardcore scene that this sort of challenges that. I mean, a lot of stuff the Nerve Agents were doing was like, in very slight ways, challenging people who we love dearly because they were like part of this community, but we wanted them to be thinking about what it was that was happening rather than just numbing out and listening to another hardcore band. Right.
Sure.
So, I mean, that's always the point of, you know, having message driven music, and also to like challenge your own rather than just preach to the choir kind of thing.
Did you see more diversity in your fan base after this record?
Oh, hell yeah. Yeah. It really shifted, but at the same time, like the hardcore base stayed really solid. Like it never really went away. Like we didn't lose many people by the eye makeup, but I think we built more off of the Days of the White album. But then the punk folks that showed up was a lot more than ever would have shown up in the first place. I think the album gets in, you know, people get a hold of it, you know, college radio. I heard this thing was played a lot more out than say like the self-title. I don't know if I ever heard the self-title being played, but Days of the White Owl was picked up more by like punk college radio stations. Definitely the record store people who are really into punk, really, really love this album. And I think they were pushing it on a lot of people. So I think we were getting a lot of support once it came out, because I think it really spoke to a larger audience just by its sound.
You turn around the third record really quick. You know, it's a couple years between the self-titled and the Days of the White Owl, but the Butterfly record comes out just a year later. How are you able to crank out something so quickly? And how do you feel about that?
Well, I felt fine with it. I mean, I guess it felt like most of the bands around us were, at least bands that were doing album after album, were doing it like a year at a time. The funny thing is that we didn't tour the same way that those bands did. So we were kind of like, you know, we weren't like blowing up all over the map or anything. I think we became known within like sort of, I don't know how we became known, but it certainly wasn't like we weren't running around on a Warp Tour. You know what I mean?
Sure.
So I think with releasing an album a year later totally makes sense to me, because our writing process and how much these guys like really were so good at just writing music, you know, they just turned out music and quality stuff too. you know, the Butterfly Collection is like a whole new level of stuff. You know, it gets really wild and chaotic and just goes into all different places and, you know, feels almost like more artsy, if anything. Not that it is artsy, but it just kind of feels that way. Because it wasn't so, if you take the self title and put it up against the Butterfly Collection, it looks very different. You know, yet it's the same people.
Yep.
So I.
Go ahead. Sorry.
I was going to say, but I think the songs on it are solid. You know, there's some interesting stuff in there, but I think that they're all like really solid as songs.
No, I think it's really good. And it just doesn't seem like it's as revered as the second one. And I just wonder if it's because the turnaround is so quick. Like maybe if it had one more year to breathe and you put it out, it'd be like, holy shit, how did the Nerve Agents put out like three great LPs, you know? Instead, it's like just back to back. So I wonder if it gets just compared a little too much.
Yeah, you know, I feel like most people who... I don't know. I feel like most people know Days of the White Owl. And then if they like know this band, they generally know the Revelation stuff. I feel like Hellcat. Well, I know that so we took off and started to tour, but you know, one of the things that a lot of record labels do is that, you know, if your record doesn't sell in the first, you know, certain amount of time, whatever they decide, then they're suddenly going to move on and drop the funding for advertising and things like that. And that definitely happened to us. And I don't know that Hellcat really knew what to do with us, you know, because we didn't really kind of fall into, you know, a certain place, right? And we weren't touring like most bands that were doing a third album were touring, you know. We just weren't doing that level of stuff. You know, I was working full time and, you know, it just, you know, we had guys in school and, you know, we just weren't that band. And so I think we were kind of playing higher than we should have been at that point and probably just didn't really meet the mark with Hellcat, who's so used to doing like touring bands and work tour kind of stuff. At that point, people are like doing a hell of a lot more than we were doing. So I think we just kind of, that record just kind of slid sort of out of things. And you have to remember too, that we released that album in the summer of 2000. And we break up in January of 2001.
Yeah. Do you want to go? Why does a band break up?
there was some relationship dynamics with Dante and I, and they didn't get resolved. And then I quit. And really the reason that I quit was, you know, my daughter was on the way in January. My first child was being born, and I was really committed to being a dad. And so it really kind of like worked perfectly. You know what I mean? Because my primary focus became on her and would have not really been on music. And we were really struggling there in the very end. The last Nerve Agent shows were, from my perspective, really challenging because we were touring with Lars Fredriksson and the Bastards, and going around with them from San Diego to LA to a couple shows in Santa Cruz and a couple shows in San Francisco. And, you know, my voice blew out in Santa Cruz. You know, we had like two shows same day. It was like back to back. I think it was like four shows in 2 days or something like that. And my voice was out on the first show out of the four. And so it was just a big mess. But we traveled in separate cars on the tour. So it was like we were really not together at that point for various different reasons. And so it just went into like not so good territory, and some things came up between he and I, and you know, it just didn't feel right, and I quit. So,
and you don't do a last show, you just quit and the band is done.
Yeah. And you know, soon to realize, I think it was 2 weeks after our last show, and everybody realized they just saw our last show, you know, which they were good shows. They weren't good for me vocal wise because I couldn't sing, but there were so many people packed into the Pound in San Francisco that I don't think anybody really even noticed. You know, there's some video footage of it up on YouTube or something. And, you know, I was looking at it, I was like, oh, it looks like a fun show. But my voice was completely out. I couldn't even hear myself like get any words out. It was that bad.
Does a band ending like that, like, leave you feeling incomplete?
Yeah, absolutely. I think everybody felt that way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you don't do anything for several years, and then you do Said Radio in, I believe, 06-ish?
Yeah, so...
07.
It was 06 when things started. So what happened was, the Warped Tour came around to Portland, which is where I moved to. And I went out there because Timmy Chunks was out there, and I went to go see him, and the Transplants were playing. So I went and saw those guys, and they asked me to come up and play on the one song that I did with the Transplants, Romper Stomper. And so I got up and played one song, and I hadn't played in years. It was pretty funny. It wasn't funny. It was fun, but it was just weird to me. And like, you know, there's a lot of people there. All the guys in the Transplants, it was nice to see them. And then Timmy was there. And then the day after that, it really, I think, encouraged me to think about trying to do a band from Portland and fly down, because flights were cheap at the time, to California and try and make something work. And Timmy had talked about starting Redemption 87 at another time, kind of around the time we were doing the reunion shows in 2004. And so we started talking about that. And I said, well, we got to think of some people to get. And at the same time, I was talking to Dante. You know, this was like years later, Dante and I were making up for the the fallout from the nerve agents. You know, what was it, like 5 years later or something like that?
Yeah.
And just really felt like the nerve agents were unresolved, and you know, it was a bummer, but we'd made up and everything was fine between us. And it was kind of funny because we could have done that back then. But we didn't because of ego. And he decided, after I asked him, to join this band with Timmy Chunks. And Gary from Redemption 87 was on board. And so we got Mark Hayworth, who was in Inside Out. And that was our new band. It was called Strange Young Heroes. And we actually flew to LA, had band practice, but Mark was touring with Rancid. And that just, he wasn't really going to be back around for a very long time. So we were really kind of wanted to continue playing, but, you know, it was kind of hard because one, we had two guys in LA, two guys in the Bay Area, and one guy in Portland. So I was talking with Gary and Dante about maybe we could just do kind of like a side thing, like just in the Bay Area, because we can't, you know, it'd be really hard to bring up Timmy because Timmy had some challenges down in LA from getting up there, which is why we're going to LA. So anyway, we ended up starting something completely separate from the Strange Young Heroes. So we were hoping that when Mark got back, we would continue to do the Strange Young Heroes, but we ended up doing this thing in the Bay Area, which turned out to be Said Radio. And Strange Young Heroes never materialized because Timmy thought we were playing without him. And which we've since worked that one out. But at the time, he thought we were doing this without him. So the Strange Young Heroes were kind of no more. And so Said Radio was kind of born at that time. And then we ended up pulling some other folks into the band. Kind of, we never had anybody stick. It was really interesting until Anthony from Ceremony ended up sticking in the band. But we recorded like a little 8-song album, which I actually really liked, and toured on the East Coast for like a week. And it was all in 2007. And played some shows in Southern California, played some shows, a couple shows in the Bay Area. But there wasn't a lot of movement with it because I couldn't commit full time. And so it never really got off the ground. So we had the band for about 3 years and it just sort of trickled away. We played some shows here and there with Tiger Army. Did some stuff there, which was awesome. Nick was really great and giving us all these shows all over the place. And that eventually just kind of faded away. That was all on me because, you know, I was raising my daughter by myself and trying to go to school to get a master's degree. And that's what happened.
Yeah, it's a super cool record, though. I mean, it's straightforward. Thanks. Kind of in the way that Nervigious is, but it's a little wilder on the guitar. Like, there's some crazy, noisy stuff meshed in, like... I don't know. It's a very interesting record. And
yeah, well, let me bridge that for you just a little bit because you're making a really good point. So Dante and I, part of I think what was going on with he and I was that we were not on the same page. You know, I had kind of an adherence to hardcore as the foundation of the Nerve Agents, and we could never really go away from that. It always had to be at least foundationally what held the band together musically. And he didn't come from that. You know, he came from all kinds of stuff that was like punk and he listened to all kinds of things, but he was never like really a youth crew hardcore kind of guy, right? And so me being like 8 years, I think I'm like 9 or 10 years older than Dante, it became kind of like a relationship where I dominated the band because I'd been in so many bands and this was sort of, I was always running everything. And he had different ideas and wanted to kind of branch out, but I would always kind of corral him into what we were doing because he came on late and wasn't really part of the initial understanding of things. But I mean, he did fine with it, but I think he started to get a little bit more like, why do we always have to listen to this guy? You know, that kind of thing.
Sure.
And they wanted to do things that were really not, I think, what were kind of what we were doing in the Nerve Agents. So I think that created somewhat of a rift between he and I. And we talked about this later with Said Radio. I said, look, we're going to do this band. And, you know, he and I both talked about how we wished that we did another Nerve Agents record. It would have been so awesome, right? So he was going to play guitar because that's pretty much like his main instrument anyway. And I said, I'm not going to tell you any which way to do anything. I'm not going to tell you that you got to be like founded in this or that. So he just kind of did his thing. And I think his anchor was sort of the Nerve Agents, right? Because that's what we knew together. But at the same time, he was sort of free to kind of do what he wanted musically. that was his realm. He could sort of call the shots on that. And so that's what happened with said radio, which is why you see the guitar in the way that you do, is because it's Dante just sort of branching out and being more Dante than he could be in the Nerve Agent.
Right. The songs in general and your voice keeps it in the lane, but the guitar does get a little more zany.
Yeah. 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 Well, even I'm doing some different stuff on that album, because I wanted to, again, you know, try and challenge myself to do some things different. You know, I remember I was listening to like some Nick Cave stuff that I brought into my vocals on some of, you know, I think it was like Tidal Waves and Teeth, and just kind of just gotten in this sort of freewheeling kind of way with how I was coming at the vocals. So there's more kind of like loony sort of offerings from my end.
Sure.
But it was fun, you know, it was fun, and it was very much, I really love the lyrics on there for the message. I think it's really stuff that I probably would stand behind today. In a lot of ways. And I remember when I was writing a lot of the songs, and, you know, thinking now that I'm a parent, what would I say to my kids? Like, you know what I mean? I didn't want to be like, you know, burn down the White House kind of stuff. I was really like trying to put out stuff that really resonated with me as a human being, and also to put something out there that I could say to my daughter, yeah, that still stands for me.
So, you know? Yeah, for sure. What have you done since then?
That's it.
And how does that feel, like being so musical your whole life and then transitioning into, you know, working and parenting? Do you feel a void, or do you feel like you've laid enough out there as a canvas that like you're satisfied as an artist?
Yeah, I would say it's both. I think with where I'm at in my life, what I, you know, so music to me was always about reaching people, putting sort of this certain kind of energy in the world. It was very much what Ray Capo and Youth of Today did for me. It was me doing the same thing, trying to reach people. On the Unit Pride album, there's a song called One Will Do. I still adhere to that even in the work I do today. And, you know, it's really about, like, for me, kind of putting out this positive, hopeful sort of message. Sometimes in my lyrics, it's not always that positive or hopeful, but usually, even the darkest stuff, there's a shift in the song to something positive or hopeful, you know, believing in yourself and like, you know, being able to stand up for yourself or, you know, making change. Like those kinds of things are constant themes, you know, dumping materialism, that kind of stuff, you know, stuff that I still, kind of strive to put out as a message to. Like now I'm a clinical social worker, so I work with people and try and, you know, get them, you know, guided sort of down the road in a different way than how they come to me. And, you know, the idea is that I don't want to do it for them. I want to empower them by like trying to like help them see things in different ways. So a lot of what I was doing in music, or how I saw I was doing music, and maybe this is just a total like being naive and thinking that I was reaching people in this way, but trying to be there and bring people to the place where they can connect with the thing that I'm saying, or the music they were putting out there, or even the performance of playing live that would inspire somebody to kind of move forward in this positive way. You know, to look at things differently, to challenge themselves, that has always been the thing. So I think leaving that behind with all of these albums or all of these experiences that people have had by coming to the shows live or you know, just the way engaging with that community at shows is huge for me that I've done all of that. Is there a void? Yeah. Cause it's in my blood. I mean, it's just truly something that doesn't ever go away. It's like, I don't know how to explain it, but you know, I don't feel like every day, I wish I was playing again. But, you know, like we're sitting here talking now and I'm like, oh yeah, that would be awesome.
Yeah.
You know?
Well,
so it's hard because some days I really am like, I should call this person, just start a band. I can do it quarter time, no problem, you know, but truly that's not real. You know, it's not what my consistent energy at this point in time says. I've really married myself to my work as a social worker, which is really just an extension of what I was doing in music. The creative aspect has been switched out for, you know, I started writing. I haven't written much in the last couple of months for a whole bunch of reasons, but I started writing like almost two years ago and really love the creative aspect of that. And it really helps me kind of funnel all of my creative energy into something where I can take the emotions of the day or politics or whatever and really put it into the writing. And again, the work of a social worker is constantly engaging in so many ways that I did when I was playing music.
Do you think that your writing will end up landing on a platform somehow?
I don't know. You know, I'm really writing for myself at this point. So if I'm done writing what is now going to be essentially a book when it's done, because I have like 260 pages of a novel that I've worked on, or if I switch gears and write something else, once it's complete, if I feel it's worthwhile, then I would float something out there, but I'm not like aggressively trying to find a way to get it out, you know? So I think I've been fortunate enough in my life to be able to, if I have something like that, it finds its way to where it needs to go.
I think that's awesome.
And, yeah.
Yeah. Is there anything else you want to end with or anything else you want to say?
You know, I don't know that there is. I think just, you know, I do appreciate the podcast and certainly what you're putting out there. And I think collecting, you know, these kinds of, you know, histories with people and just kind of the experiences through this is so awesome that you're doing this. And, you know, I appreciated my time playing in the scene and still being connected to it in various different ways through different people. But, you know, like the change has to come and the new people are rising up and it's time for somebody else, you know?
For sure. I mean, at the end of the day, it needs to be a youth movement.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Do you feel like you've been well represented on the pod?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, you let me talk way too much. And anybody who knows me knows I'll talk way too much. So.
Oh, you're perfect for the platform. The less I have to do, the better. You know, I try to have people on that talk better than me, and I try to be the worst talker to set everyone at ease.
Well, I appreciate how you've approached it for sure. You know, it's been a good time.
All right. I appreciate you coming on. Thanks so much, Eric.
Hey, thank you, Zach. You take care of yourself.
All right. You as well. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.